Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Amanda Howard is a best-selling true crime author, fiction writer, and violent crimes consultant who has written 19 books over the past 14 years, including 10 books on a wide range of true crime cases. She has also interviewed some of the world's most heinous serial killers over two decades and has collected a vast pool of information on various types of killers, their motives, and rituals. In Killer Minds, Amanda Howard investigates 60 cases of serial murder from around the world. Using primary resources and the actual words of the serial killers, Amanda reconstructs both infamous and lesser-known crimes and provides an insight into the minds of serial killers. The book is broken into the following chapters: child killers, strangers we know, thrill killers, killer kids, poisoners, group killers, black widows, and parents who kill. The book that we're featuring this evening is Killer Minds, an insight into the minds of serial killers, with my special guest, journalist and author, Amanda Howard. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Amanda Howard.
Hi, Dan. Welcome from Australia.
Thank you very much for calling all the way from Australia. Thank you very much. Incredible book. Let's get to a little bit about why you wrote this book. You talk about the purpose in a new definition, you say, a new definition, because the other definition is far too vague to encapsulate the varying types of multiple murderers, and therefore you want to show that there are many possible subcategories that are more definitive than the all-encompassing term a serial killer. Tell us a little bit about that.
That's right, Dan. What we actually have is that everyone thinks of the serial killer, and we think of, you know, Dahmer and Gacy and Bundy and all of these big cases, which are actually more of a subspecies of a sex serial killer. But as you mentioned, my book actually goes into sort of different sorts, because we have our child killers. Now, the child killers tend to sort of look at a specific victim type, obviously, but the way they kill children is often very different to the way that Bundy killed his victims. And then we go into the known strangers, and that's these men, and Gacy fits into this category, where they're, you know, these high functioning, great members of the community, and everyone knows them, and they're great friends with everybody, but they harbour this secret, and sort of that gives them a sort of different sort of subspecies as well. And then we go into killers like the thrill killers, who, like Ivan Milat, who's a local case here, they actually kill because they just want to kill. It's not about the sexual element so much as about the hunting. So there's a fair few killers that go into that category. Our killer kids, again, is a very different category that I could probably, actually, I think I did write a book on this case. But there's a lot of children who go on to kill that tend to be due to an arrested development. And so why they kill at such a young age is just a fascinating topic. And again, they're very different to our sexual killers. Our poisoners, obviously, that's about a quick dispatch often, and it's about getting rid of people who are in their way, or for the pure joy of it. A couple of other sort of categories. I mean, we have our tandem killers, and on my own podcast, we do a lot of these tandem killer cases, because there's that fascination of that dynamic that happens between the stronger killer and the weaker killer, and how they can interact and function, and how these people come together in a type of perfect storm, and how they can create a murderous campaign that may not have happened if they didn't get together. And then, of course, we have our parents who kill, which is a very graphic topic that goes into these parents who, you know, like as a parent myself, I don't understand, but I try to understand how they decide that they would have these babies and just continually kill them over years. I mean, we had Mary Beth Chitting, who just died recently, who likely killed 8 of her 9 children. And wow, it's just shocking that they can go that far and carry these babies and just end up deciding that that's what's going to happen within a very few, sometimes hours, sometimes days, sometimes months. But it's quite, it just shows that the serial killer term is far too broad these days. I mean, when the FBI started their research, they were looking at people like Kemper, who was very much in this very small sample size. They were all the same age. Most of them were white. They all had pretty much female victims. And so it was a very concentrated sample. But since that time, you know, we've seen people like Derek Todd who killed across racial lines and all of this sort of stuff that sort of breaks down that profile. And I'm sorry, I'm going on. No, you've got me talking now, Dan. I'm so sorry. But shows that we need to sort of go into more depth and break down that umbrella of the term serial killer.
You did have a couple issues before we get into some incredible dramatic examples in these categories that you have in this book, in the 60 stories that you have featured. You also talk about that you cite an author, Stephen Egger, in 1998 that did a different classification for serial killers. And then you say that as well, that there needs to be more of a definition, you say a further definition, to be able to include all kinds of other killers as you do. Where is there still some controversy? We've seen in the last few years from the definition, I think it's the FBI that has said it, from 3 murders adjusted down to 2 murders with that same kind of psychopathology evident. Where is there some controversy today about serial killing and its definition, and where do you, in this book, see a difference?
Well, I mean, one of the first things is that they talk about that they kill their victims in different locations. So instantly, Gacy doesn't fit. I mean, yes, his last 3 victims he dumped because his crawl space was full. But had it not been full, he would have continued to kill it at his own house. So there's always exceptions to the rule. So we really need to make sure that we can sort of break down these classifications and change it to suit various subspecies of serial killer, because you know, Cass Folbig, who is a child killer here in Australia, does not fit into the same category as Ed Kemper, who killed co-eds in the 1970s. So we need to sort of break it down, because the profiles that we have are very, very basic, and we need to sort of create these subcategories where we can have the child killers, we can have the killer children, we can have the tandem killers, we can have the poisoners, the black widows, and all of these sorts of cases, because they can't fit together. And, you know, we expect to just say serial killer and we think Bundy, but we never sort of think of Mark Dutroux and other cases that we're going to go into today. So I think there's extra sort of profiling sections for each of these different subcategories.
Right. Now, in the child killers category, and we talked about this beforehand, and I thought it was just me losing, like I said, my edge a little bit, but you have included, I can't see, absolutely have to be the worst examples of child killers in the history of the world. And as you and as we explained to the audience, this book is a collection, so you have held back some of the details, and yet this is incredibly hard to read. Let's talk about Mark Dutroux. And also, just as you mentioned before the show, tell us about the research done to be able to write about Mark Dutroux and what that research meant in terms of your health.
Well, Mark Dutroux, I actually wrote a book a few years ago called Predators, and the Dutroux case was one that I thought, oh yeah, he killed a couple of kids, I'll add him in. And then once I started researching the case, Mark Dutroux was incarcerated for only 5 victims, though there's a bit of controversy even about that. But going into this case, what they found was he was likely a small fish in a very, very big pond, this massive pedophile ring that was happening in Belgium at the time that actually went all the way to royalty. There was judges involved, police, local parliamentary members. It was this massive rotten underbelly of Belgium. And they actually put out a call for people who believed that they were victims of this pedophile ring to come forward and give their statements. So what I read during that is some of the most horrific, graphic detail that I have ever... Oh, I couldn't have even imagined it. There is evidence of young girls having babies and they kill the babies as they're born. Like, I mean, we are talking graphic, horrific stuff, including photographs of children in submissive poses and sexually explicit S&M and all of this sort of horrific stuff that I threw my laptop across the room and stopped writing. It sent me to a therapist. I couldn't cope with what I had just seen and read. I mean, we as authors, we try to keep a distance, but sometimes the darkness does get in. And I had a young daughter at the time. She's now a teenager, but at the time, there was one picture of this one little girl who looked like her, and it just broke me. And I thought, why am I doing this? What's going on? I've just read the most horrific stuff, that these people are evil. There's nothing worse than the information that I read, that I had to go and see a therapist. I had to stop writing. I had to leave it alone. The publisher didn't really like that, but they had to deal with that. But it was about me realizing that though we think that we can keep a distance, we're human, and we need to be able to feel that these emotions and these poor victims and these girls that who are now in their 30s and 40s and what they went through and the torture and what they saw and being passed around all of these pedophile groups and you know, it involved their parents and their grandparents and all of this sort of horrific detail that I read that I couldn't put in the book. It's just too horrific. But it just sort of created this feeling in me that there's evil and then there's those that are beyond evil. And it was a tough case to get through. I eventually did return to the book, and Mark Dutroux then also appears in Killer Minds as well. But it's a case that will always be up there with just a few others that created nightmares for me. And, you know, we go to bed and we try and think about the nice things and think about our families, but there's some cases that do get in, and Mark Dutroux was one of them.
I hate to ask you questions about that case after that, but I'm hoping we can
No, please do, Dan.
That don't go into too much graphic depot. Like I say, this story to me, as I mentioned to you, is some stories really are visual, and I can really visualize them because they are so incredibly movie-esque in my mind, and that means somewhat, if not almost completely, like a horror movie plot. And I've seen a lot of horror movies when I was a kid. So this stuff is of the true murder, true horror variety. You talk about this, we won't get into his early life. Everybody says they had horrible things happen to him when they were young, but needless to say, when he was 20 years old, he was married and he had a couple sons, and then he was divorced, and she claimed horrific spousal violence and sexual abuse of the children. At that point, he had an affair with this Michelle Martin, and it became his second wife. I'm not correct.
Yeah, you are. Yep.
He used to have a white van, and we talk about he starts stalking children at swimming centers around Belgium in his white van. Who is, just to outline the horror of this story and why it's so horrific, is can you tell us who is in company, who is he in company with when he does this, and then introduce some of the couple of his friends that he is associated with? You talked about and alluded to the pedophile ring, but how does it start with these four members?
As you said, there's four. So his wife, Michelle, actually becomes part of this gang. And she was often used as a ruse to get a lot of the girls towards the van. You know, she would do, like we know Carla Malka did in Canada, ask for directions, and you know, these children always were happy to help. And so they would get them towards the van. And in the van was Michelle... I'm going to stuff this name, I'm sorry. It's Lelevi, which is a French surname, I'm sure, that you would probably do better, Dan. And he was actually a main partner to Dutroux, and the two of them would do a lot more. And there was a few others that helped, including a guy called Weinstein, who ended up being a victim of Dutroux's because he was boasting to people and everything. And so Marc Dutroux actually killed him. So he is one of his victims, which sort of confuses that serial killer term again, because his chosen victims were females, but he did kill one of his companions. And there was other people involved that were important members of society. And so they would grab the girls, they would tie them up in the vans and sexually assault them and often dump them. And they did this for years and years and years until they decided to make it a bit more of a permanent arrangement. And what they did was Marc Dutroux under one of his homes, and he had multiple homes, and he was unemployed, and people knew that he had all these homes, and he had all of this construction equipment and big giant excavators and all of this sort of stuff. No one questioned it, which sort of suggested that people knew what was going on because they were members of the police and all of this that were involved, that they just turned a blind eye. And what happened was that he actually abducted two 8-year-old girls. So Julie Lelejeune and Melissa Rousseau. I'm sorry about the pronunciation of some of these names. And he took them back to his home in Belgium, and they produced videos and all of this sexual assault of these two 8-year-old girls. Now, how they actually died was Dutroux actually went to jail for car theft, and he told his wife to keep them alive, and she was too scared to go into the dungeon to feed them, and so they ended up starving to death.
Yes.
So it's just absolutely horrific what those two little 8-year-old girls went through, and I read the case file, and it's pretty horrific what their last couple of months of life were like. Yeah, but going on from there, they actually, Lelev and Dutroux actually then abducted Anne Michelle and Effie Lambrex. Now, they were 18-year-old girls, but they looked a lot younger. And so it was almost an accidental abduction because they wanted younger girls. And so they were kept for only a very short time. And then they were drugged and buried alive. And they were buried beside Weinstein, because he had sort of stuffed up with the abduction of those two girls, so gone. So it's actually quite shocking, but that they were kept for a short time. And then I think it was 1996, Dutroux ended up kidnapping Sabine Dardenne, who was a 12-year-old girl. And there was a big outcry about that there was girls being abducted, and this girl had disappeared, and she was actually gone for quite some time, and they kept looking for them. And police had actually been to Dutroux's house several times and had heard children crying out, asking for help, but they could never find them because the way that they were hidden in these dungeons, which are very much like the Fritzl case in Austria a couple of years ago, that these doors are hidden behind shelving and all of this sort of stuff. So though they could hear them and knew that they were there, they didn't find them and didn't keep trying to find them, so that they could have probably saved the first two girls and then saved the others. But thankfully, Sabine, and there was another girl that was abducted just before they were captured, Leticia Delhez, and they were kept and raped repeatedly during their captive period. But then the press and the public had caused such a great outcry that they knew where to find them because someone had seen the spooky white van when he had abducted Leticia. So they were able to go and get them within a couple of weeks of her abduction. So the last two girls did survive, and both of them spoke out at length at the trial of Dutroux, who went on with the whole "I'm just a small fish" pedophile group. But Sabine and Leticia said that they only were raped by him, and so that's where the trial went, and they refused to investigate further. There was a judge that wanted it to go higher, and that's where all of the witness testimony come from of all these other victims, but he was actually sacked and told to not look into this and to leave it alone, and so only Dutroux and his gang of Michelle Martin and Michelle Lelève went to prison for these cases.
You say, too, millions of Belgians watched on live TV the sentencing.
Yes, and then there was a massive outcry. It was called the White March. They all dressed in white and had white balloons to sort of represent all of the victims of Dutroux and of the disgusting mess that was happening in Belgium at the time, because names were being thrown around. As I said, I went into the royal family, and there is this one person in the royal family that they know was very important in his pedophile ring, but he's never going to be charged or incarcerated for this. But the Belgian people tried to have it changed and fixed, and they did a lot, but it just come down to this small group of four people, and only three were incarcerated. And Michelle Martin is actually out of prison now. But they knew something was happening, and that there was too many rumours for there not to be evidence, but it was just shut down. But, I mean, a lot of the information is online. You can actually look up the ex-dossiers and read these transcripts of these interviews with these girls who now at 30 and 40, what they had experienced as you know, 3, 4, 5, 15-year-olds. It's just been horrific, but no one went into it. And actually, one of the victims who spoke out, Regina Louf, people went on news programs and current affairs shows to actually discredit her and just say, oh, no, she's a crazy crackpot, and this didn't happen and that didn't happen. But she was able to take people to the places where these things happened, where bones were found and blood splatter was found and everything, and they still chose to ignore her case.
You talk about some of the outrage with that. Was there outrage? We talk about judicial systems in the U.S. and Canada, Australia, U.K., different. In Belgium, was there outrage to the sentences? Because you see, Michelle Martin didn't do any time or was released because he had to care for her child. And then this Michel Niol, I probably didn't pronounce that properly, he was acquitted of all charges, but he did get 5 years for drug-related charges. So he escaped from charges, essentially, two of this, again, seemed like a big pedophile group, but only a few people convicted. And those sentences, was there outrage at that leniency at those sentences or any of those decisions?
Well, there was a little bit, but there was more outrage that Dutroux was allowed to go to the law library by himself during the trial and after the trial to look at appealing his case, and was able to walk out of prison and escape for quite a few weeks. I mean, this guy was so protected. that he had such freedoms. And even now, he's been contacting the families of his victims, claiming that he wants to apologize, hoping that it will let him out of prison. I mean, he's only been in prison for about 20 years. Jeez. And he wants out. And I mean, the judge that was digging into this case, he was sacked purely because he had a dinner with the victim's families, and they said, "Oh no, this is instantly a conflict of interest. You can't look into this case." And they brought in someone who just basically just washed the case away and said, "Yeah, Mark Dutroux's guilty. Go to prison. Go away, everyone else." So I mean, everyone knew that there was corruption involved. Even a million people marching in the streets wasn't enough to change the outcome or to create enough buzz to make them fight this further and to get the real ring leaders involved. Because, I mean, it's still going on. And that's the scary part. Mark Dutroux might be in prison, but this pedophile ring is still going on.
That is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about another. You break things down into subcategories, and you say known strangers versus the unknown stranger, or the stranger, I should say, serial killer. Mm-hmm.
Distinction?
Why that difference in terms? Sorry.
Yeah. No, that's okay. Because we have these people that are, we are always led to believe that serial killers are these scary, you know, monsters with a limp and a scar and all of this sort of stuff, but they're actually very much a part of our community. But we have those who take the opportunity to just grab someone off the street and take them. So they're our stranger killings. They're the ones who see the opportunity and take it. Whereas the known strangers like John Wayne Gacy and Dean Call, they're members of the community and people actually flock to them. And so to procure their victims, both Gacy and Call used younger boys to actually entice people to their house. And they would often go a couple of times before they were actually killed. So they got to know their victims and their victims got to know their killer before everything ended up horrifically wrong. So that's the distinction there. So it's about building relationships with their victims. It might just be a few hours, but often Gacy or Call would actually have people come to their home and they'd smoke weed for a while and they'd watch pornos or play a couple of games of pool. So it wasn't about getting them in the house and attacking and killing them, whereas the stranger killings often do that. They actually go and grab a victim, take them home, and they're dead pretty quickly, often after a shortened period of torture. These known strangers take that time and they're able to create an environment where they're comfortable enough to do the killings. Dean Call used two boys, so Brooks and Henley, to entice some of the teenage boys to come to his home in Houston. And they would play pool for a while and they'd get drunk. And, you know, teenage boys would be happy to do that. I mean, most teenagers want to go and get drunk. And so that's what would happen is that they would go and party until they would often wake up tied to Dean Call's torture board, and then that they'd be sodomized, they'd be beaten, they'd be tortured, and then that they'd be killed and buried in a boat shed that he'd hired. So it's very different to the opportunistic killers that we have. And this is how these sorts of known strangers like Gacy and Call get up to, Dean Call had 28 victims and Gacy had 33, and this is how they do it, because Dean Call had a local candy business and people knew him and he was part of the society. He was a veteran, and it was just no one would have suspected him. So this is how he was able to get to at least 28 victims.
Let's use this as an opportunity, Amanda, just to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor, Meason. Meason is a kitchen cookware company that makes high-end kitchen necessities for a fraction of the price. Just like any job, having the right tools can make all the difference, and cooking is no different. A solid high-end knife is essential for any home chef. The problem until now, that your only options were cheap and low quality or something expensive. Until now. My wife and I received our two Meissen knives, a butcher knife and a paring knife, and immediately we could see and feel the quality construction, just how very sharp the knives were and how well they felt as you were using them and cutting with them. And they look great. One knife does it all. Giant knife sets can be a waste of space in your kitchen and money in your wallet. The Meissen knife can replace 99% of what all knives in your big stand set can do, much cheaper than other competitors. By selling directly to you, the consumer, Meissen is able to cut out the middleman and save you money. And free sharpening for life. Even the sharpest knives eventually dull. Meissen knows how aggravating this can be, so they offer free sharpening for life. Just send the knife back when it dulls, and they'll ship it back good as new. I've tried the Meissen knife, and I don't know how I ever cooked without it. Cooking is faster and actually more fun. And now you can also join in the fun in the kitchen. My listeners will receive 20% off their order simply by going to Meissen.com/murder and using my code MURDER. That's Meissen.com/murder for 20% off your order. Meissen.com/murder, and don't forget to use my code MURDER. You were talking about Dean Corll and such an incredible example of your known stranger classification for serial killers. Let's talk more about Dean Corll, and you mentioned his accomplices, Brooks and Henley. When we spoke before the program, you mentioned that you had been in correspondence with this Henley. Explain that before we go more into and dive into the story of Dean Corll or the Candyman.
Well, Wayne Henley was actually meant to be a victim. He was recruited by David Brooks, who had been enticing victims to Corll's home since the age of 12. Now, Henley was just a young teenager when he was brought to the home, and he ended up being a better accomplice than Brooks was, who was starting to get old. So Corll began using Henley as his, you know, carrot on the end of the stick to get other victims in. Henley's been in prison since the late 1960s, and he was only 17 then. So do the math, he's quite old now, and he has spent his entire adult life in prison as an accomplice. Now, though we don't feel sympathy for these people who murder children or kill anyone, but you have to wonder if there's something there that even at 17, Henley was under duress from Corll, and as I said, you can't be sympathetic, but you have to wonder that he was just a pawn in Corll's game. And, you know, he has spent all of this time in prison as an accomplice to a horrific serial killer. And I don't know if a lifelong sentence was the right sentence in this case. I believe that had he not come into Corll's home, he may never have killed. And I don't think he's a serial killer. He is someone who was just put into that environment where it was kill or be killed. And I don't know, it just messes with my head a bit. And Brooks is the same. Brooks was incarcerated too. And as far as I'm aware, he's still in prison as well. Actually, I know he's still in prison. There is a twist to Henley's case in that on one day, 1968, I think it was, he actually brought a female victim home. And Corll got really, really upset by it because his preference was for teenage boys. And so Corll drugged them all, and Henley woke up tied to the board like the other victims were. And he sort of convinced Corll to let him go, and together he would kill the female victim and Corll would kill the male victim that he'd bought. And they sort of, Corll let Henley go, and he pretended to rape his girlfriend that he brought to the house, and then sort of teased him about something, and the two got into a fight, and Cole became angry and said to Henley, "Well, you know, if you don't like this, well, you're just going to have to kill me." And kept going at him and going at him, and Henley actually grabbed a gun and shot Dean Cole dead. So there's actually a recording out there of Wayne calling his mum and saying, "I shot Dean," and it's a weird moment because her response is, "Oh no." You know, her son just rung her and said, "I've murdered someone," and there's no, she doesn't ask what happened, how, like, what's going on. It's just, oh no, it's actually quite odd. It sort of suggests to me that she knew something wrong was going on, and this was the outcome that she wasn't surprised by. So then, Henley and Brooks took the police to the boat shed where they started to dig up all of these boys. So, and the two of them have been in prison ever since, and Cole never faced justice because Henley shot him dead.
You also talk about, with this case, again, something out of a Twilight Zone, this Rhonda Williams that you were talking about that was brought here that precipitated Coral being shot by Henley, was incidentally the girlfriend of a previous victim of Dean Coral, Brooks and Henley, or at least Dean Coral. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, that's right. She's actually finally been able to not move on from this, but able to speak out about it. She actually wrote a book a few years ago about her experience because she was there when a serial killer was shot dead by one other serial killer, and you know, Brooks was brought in very quickly after that. There was a lot of relationships with a lot of the victims. I mean, we're talking about boys in a small geographical area, so a lot of them knew each other, and there's all these boys disappearing, and the police, like they did with Gacy, just assumed they'd all run away. So no one saw it as a spike or that there was an issue going on, or, you know, it was just too great a coincidence that all these teenage boys were suddenly not being found. But the investigations weren't happening. So, no, the boys run away, we're not going to look. So all of these families stood around this boat shed and saw their boys get pulled out. And you think 28 victims at least. Where could have the police stopped this from happening? Where could they have thought, hang on a sec, let's look into this, and everyone goes, oh, the last place that they were seen was Dean Cole's place. But no one did that until Henley shot Dean Cole dead. This was going to continue.
Yeah. The other, again, Twilight Zone moment is that, to further how diligent the police were, is that Billy Balsh, 17-year-old, was killed, and less than 2 years later, his brother Michael Balsh is another victim, November 72.
Mm-hmm.
Again, what's the odds of Rhonda Williams connected to a victim and then two brothers in this horror?
Yep, exactly. And you know, even if the police had looked at the Balsh family, they would have realized that these boys had no reason to run away. And maybe, you know, Billy was early. He was early 70s, I think. And, you know, his brother was a few years after that. You know, there is all of these opportunities that this could have been stopped, but it just continued. And like two boys in one family are just... the heartbreak I feel for those parents.
How did people reconcile it, and how do you explain? Again, I've seen a lot of explanations for people participating in things. People normally, when they're charged, will say that person, the partner, forced them to do the things that they did, usually proven otherwise in court. You talk about these, you know, David Brooks and Henley luring these other boys to this, to be tied to a torture rack. And we're talking, I won't even get into the details, but incredible torture of these boys. How do you reconcile that these boys would go do that for any, regardless of any motivation or threat? How?
I think that they were under threat. I think that Cole said, you know, if you don't bring a boy this weekend, you'll be strapped to it. I mean, Henley woke up strapped to it, and he knew that he had to survive. So it come to a head. But I think, you know, they brought almost 30 boys into the house. So they knew what was going to happen to these boys. And, I mean, it's 12 when he first started to take victims. 12. So, I mean, you also have to think about the parents. Why are you letting your 12-year-old boy hang with this man day after day, week after week, and not question it? I don't know. I feel sorry for Brooks and Henley, but yes, at the same time, as you said, they knew what was going to happen. They participated in what happened, and they helped kill these victims. So they're equally as culpable, but I think they wouldn't have become serial killers themselves. It's just under the guidance of Cole that this happened.
You have so many fascinating cases here, including Nadine Corll. You include Albert Fish, John Wayne Gacy, Thomas Piper, and Enriqueta Marti. You have, again, we talked about the killer kids. Maybe we can talk about this particularly sad case, this Mary Bell, and a very odd case as well. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about your story about Mary Bell.
Mary Bell is currently out in the world somewhere with her daughter. She'd be, I don't know right now, in her 60s, I'd say. Now, she is one of the youngest children ever charged with murder, and not only one, but she had two victims. Now, Mary Bell in England in the 1960s strangled two young boys. So they were about 4 years old. But not only did she strangle them, she actually stabbed their corpses and etched her name into one of the boys' chests. Now, this was a bad child, but again, we talk about their horrific upbringings, and for a child to kill a 10, it's been a horrific journey to that point. She had been prostituted by her mother. She'd been abused by so many people. She'd been in and out of girls' homes and all of this. So it culminated in a very short spree of two killings. And she actually had a friend help her with one of the victims, whose surname was also Bell, which is quite surprising. But Shay was actually slightly older, but it was Mary who was the instigator. And she actually, like the day before her 11th birthday, she lured a four-year-old boy called Martin to an abandoned house. And she actually did this herself. And she took the boy there and strangled him and sort of harmed his corpse. And then a couple of months later, with Norma Bell, they took a three-year-old boy to some wasteland, and the two of them sort of attacked him, and she etched a big M across his stomach. And she sort of mutilated his genitals and cut his hair off and basically just sort of did a lot of anger harm. So she sort of acted out all of her probably pent-up anger and frustration that she had at home on this three-year-old boy. And the scary part is that when she killed her first victim, the family had a viewing, and that they were preparing for the funeral and everything. And Mary turned up and said, "I want to see his dead body." Just as plain as that, you know. And they're like, "You're an 11-year-old girl, please, you know, this is very sad." And she's like, no, I want to see him. You know, she was that sort of blasé about it. So she was put in prison for quite some time, and she actually escaped when she was about 16 and fell pregnant. She went for a couple of weeks and had a wild ride, yeah, and went back to prison. But in England, like we have here, children can't be held for life. Wayne Henley would have been released under UK and Australian law. So at the age of 18, she was released, given a new name. And she's been found a few times over the years, but basically the people who need to know who she is and where she is, and she's been kept safe because, I mean, it comes into culpability of a 10-year-old girl being responsible for what she'd done. And so, yeah, so she's lived a harmless life since then. So the case isn't well known, but it often comes up because of the two 10-year-old boys who killed the 2-year-old toddler in the UK in the 90s, which right. is another big case that happened. And both of those boys were released, also 18, though one of them's now back in prison for about the fifth time. So it's a case that does come up because of that. It makes you wonder what creates a 10-year-old killer. And it's something that's perplexing, and they're quite hard to actually interview and get to. I'm actually interviewing a child killer in Australia. He was 18 when he killed a victim, and it was suspected of two others. So I've been actually interviewing him for just this year so far. As I said, they're actually hard to find an interview, but I'm trying to delve into this a bit further to see what creates a child killer. So, well, a child who kills. So,
absolutely.
Quite interesting. Yeah.
On the subject of child killers or kids that kill, I should say, children who kill, you talk about William Herons. And we're talking about November 15th, 1928, he was born. Tell us a little bit about William Herons, because I think it's an indication of a really good example of stopping people before they become killers. And there was all these indications very early on that if this person could have been stopped. So tell us a little bit about William Herons, and how old was he when he began his killing spree?
Well, he was 16, 17 when he started to kill. Most people will know him as the lipstick killer, because at one of the crime scenes, written on the wall was, "For heaven's sake, catch me before I kill more. I cannot control myself." So it's one of the first cases I remember, and I think it's purely because of that lipstick scrawl. There's right. evidence to suggest that he might not have been the killer. It's one of those cases that you're either on one side of the fence or the other. When I write these cases, I go from the point that these people have been incarcerated and they've gone through appeals. If they're still in prison, it suggests that there's enough evidence to put them there. Now, Herons was convicted of three victims. So there was three female victims. They were middle age, most of them, so around 45 or so, which is my age, so I can say that. And they were stabbed and attacked, but there was sort of no suspects. And it was only that Herons had a criminal record, and he was actually captured trying to break into a home and had a gun that they believed that he was the killer. Though police at the time were looking for several other suspects, including a female at one of the scenes. And we don't know why, but we know that they believed that the second victim was actually killed by a female. So it's actually quite strange. But when Herons was arrested, they actually kept him awake for 6 days. They refused him food and water, and they used sodium pentothal on him as well as lie detectors. Now, this is a 17-year-old boy in a room with all of these police officers, no lawyer. And after 6 days, he confessed. I think he would have confessed to being Jesus Christ at that point. And right. so it's actually quite, I mean, it's quite shocking that this is how he was sentenced, was based on his own confession. And, I mean, he was Chicago's longest serving prisoner. He died at 83 in prison. So he was in there for, I'm terrible at maths, so don't make me work it out, but it's 60-odd years. And he always claimed that he had been railroaded by their tactics to confess. So he may have been innocent, but he went to jail for the case. And so he had three victims. As I said, they were all stabbed. They were also beaten. And they were they did struggle with their attacker, which I think might suggest why they thought one of the victims was killed by a female, because there was such a struggle that happened. And I don't think a male would grab lipstick as quickly as a female would to write that. But there'd been other witnesses that had seen Herons in the area, and he'd been in and out of boys' homes to that point for similar attacks. So he had gone into people's houses and taken similar things that what was taken at these three kill sites. So that sort of is a bit more evidence against him. So it's a case that's quite interesting, and one that I keep coming back to, because I think that we could dig and find more on this, whether to prove or disprove he is the killer. But 17 to 83, he was in prison. That's a very long time.
You have examples of thrill killers, Marcel Berbeau, Claus Gossmann, Richard Marquette, Ivan Milat from Australia, infamous, Anatoly Onoprienko. Briefly, tell us a little bit about this serial killer operating in the Ukraine.
Okay, well, this is a guy that from about 89 to 96, 97, he killed 52 victims. So very similar to Andrei Chikatilo, who killed sort of over a longer period of time. I think Chikatilo killed for about 25 years. Onoprienko did the same kill rate in only 9 or 10 years. So his first killings were 10 victims. So he and an accomplice, whose name was Rogozin, went into a family's house. They were robbing the place. The family came home, and rather than trying to escape or get away, Onoprienko just massacred the entire family. So like the BTK, starts with a massive killing. And over the next couple of years, he would do this. He would go into their homes and he would break in, steal what he could, and then kill the entire family. Often he would do that first and then rob the place, but often it was the other way around, that he would tie them all up and make them watch him sort of defile their homes. And then once they were dead, he would burn the house to the ground. So we had a very distinct signature to what he did. And he did this over and over and over again. He got sick of his accomplice and ended up just going it alone. And he would kill massive families. You know, he would go and kill a family of four, family of 10, a family of eight, and he would do this over and over and over again and burn the places down. So not only was he a serial killer and a burglar, he was also an arsonist. So he's one of these killers who just enjoyed what he did the first time and just kept doing it over and over and over again until he was finally captured. And obviously, when you have such a distinct pattern, police were able to quickly link them all together and knew that it was a work of a serial killer. And after the debacle of the Chikatilo case, where they believed that the Ukraine and Russia don't have serial killers because that's a US thing, they were able to quickly link all of this together, believe they had a serial killer. And so Onoprienko was actually caught quite quickly, but after a massive count of 52 victims.
In another case where he wouldn't have been stopped other than, again, just luck in terms of his uncle evicting him and then finding a cache of weapons and then calling police. If his uncle hadn't police, that death toll would be much worse, wouldn't it? Yeah.
Absolutely. He would have kept going. Yeah. With a lot of these thrill killers, it's about how they get caught. And it's often a slip up like that. I mean, it's obvious what he was doing, and there would have probably been a geographical pattern. but they get sloppy because the thrill is like a drug and they keep going and keep going and they need more and more and more, that they escalate to such a point. I mean, he was killing once a month towards the end, and they escalate until they slip up, and that's what he did there.
Yeah. You have include H.H. Holmes in as poisoners. Why is he included in with poisoners?
Well, he liked to use gas to kill some of his victims, and some of the victims that we know that he killed were poisoned. Now, he was working as a pharmacist, so that made it very easy for him to get any sort of poison that he wanted. So oftentimes with poisoners, they're able to get away with it for a very long time, and they often dispatch of their victims quite quickly, though some do it over years and years and years of slowly taking entire families out. But Holmes, he's almost a standalone case because he is so different, and you know, he burnt down his castle in Chicago, and he had used lots of different methods of killing, and there was some financial gain when he killed Benjamin Peetzel, and there's evidence to suggest that there were some sexual elements to some of his victims, but he's just a case that it was almost, where can I put him, because he can fit in so many different cases. I mean, you could also consider him a mass killer because his victims could have been, you know, in the hundreds as far as we're aware.
Right. Now, with this collection, we talked beforehand that there is plans for a Volume 2. And in Volume 2, what would be covered in that new edition?
I'd have to go and look it up, but I know there's definitely cannibals in that. I know that Volume 3 is almost going to be entirely our sex killers, so our Ted Bundys and the like. But in the next one, I think I've got my medical killers as well. So when you look at Harold Shipman and a couple of cases like that, so our nurses who kill, so Cullen and cases involving nurses. I mean, we've got Wetlaufer in Canada, which has just come through. So it's going to be just that next section of killers that don't fit under that umbrella of serial killer as easily as we'd like them to. So there's about 8 different categories in that. I would have to look it up. It proves I haven't looked at it for a couple of weeks. I've been working on some other projects. But yeah, I know that the first chapter is cannibals. I'm opening with Dahmer, which is probably, people will say he probably didn't eat a lot of his victims, but I mean, there's pieces right in the fridge for a reason. So so he's definitely the opening scene.
Absolutely, yes. Yes, this is an incredible, I don't know what to call it, a collection, but an incredible look at serial killing and this, and the way you categorize this, and the dramatic examples. And again, I can't even imagine you having to hold some of the stuff that you held back with some of these stories like Mark Dutroux and Dean Corll. And we left a lot of those details out for the reader to discover because, again, hard to read the incredible evil that these people perpetrated on their victims. And when you see other children put into servitude with this evil person, it's just, again, it's visual to me. The images that were created with this book. So I want to thank you very much, Amanda, for coming on and talking about Killer Minds. You mentioned earlier, and I forgot to mention, you also are a podcaster. So why don't you talk about your podcast and how people might be able to find it? And also, if you have a website for your books or for a personal website, let us know about that.
Okay, well, my podcast is called Monsters Who Murder, Serial Killer Confessions. We've just done our first 2 seasons. Basically, I use a lot of my first-hand experience with a lot of these killers. So I use their own words, recordings, information in letters and all of that sort of stuff. So basically the words of the killers, and then I break down not so much the killings themselves, but the motivations and the psychology behind it. So that's Monsters Who Murder. I also have a monsterswhomurder.com website, as well as amandahoward.com.au website, which is sadly out of date because I'm busy. People can also find me on Twitter at AmandaHoward73 and on Facebook and Instagram and all of those. I'm usually just Amanda Howard author or something like that. I'm pretty easy to find and I'm often on there. So I'm in lots of Facebook groups. I'm in Dan's group and all these sorts of places. So I'm around and I'm happy to talk to people about these cases. So this is what I do. They call me the serial killer whisperer because I seem to get some information out of some killers that no one else does. I've had a couple of marriage proposals over the years and a few things like that. I've sent some very interesting gifts that I do talk about on the podcast. So please come and find me.
Absolutely. Going to check that out. Absolutely. Thank you very much, Amanda Howard, for coming on and talking about the killer minds and insight into the minds of serial killers. It certainly has been a pleasure. Thank you very much, Amanda Howard. You have a great evening and hope to talk to you again real soon.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you. Good night.
Excellent.